Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Dr. Sam Kalish. He leads special projects at the nonprofit Rewiring America. He's affectionately known as Mr. Heat Pump, stemming from his travels in Washington, D.C., dressed as a heat pump. And yes, you can find him on YouTube playing that role, talking to folks on the street as well as senators. In addition to this bit of street theater, Sam has run projects with the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy's Advanced Manufacturing Office, and their Buildings Technology Office. He recently joined in the signing celebration for the Inflation Reduction Act in Washington, D.C. Rewiring America is a resource for individuals and institutions alike in getting us off fossil fuels and onto cleaner, green electricity. So here we go in our conversation with Dr. Kalish. Dr. Sam Kalish, welcome to Climate Talk.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off, Sam, if you wouldn't mind, just give us some background on what Rewiring of America is, what it does, vision, goals, those sort of things. And after we talk about that, you can tell us what got you there.
Cool. Well, yeah. So Rewiring America is a nonprofit focused on electrification, which a big part of our work is in educating people on what electrification even is, although no. So when we talk about working on climate, a lot of us have thinking that dates to the 1970s. That's about, well, if we take, you know, short showers, you know, use a little bit less energy, that's good for the climate. And while that historically has been kind of the best things we can do, recently, due to technological progress, falling costs of solar, falling costs of wind, electric vehicles, electric heat pumps, we now have much better. And what that looks like is everywhere we burn a fossil fuel today, there are now viable options to replace them with new efficient electric machines. So instead of a gasoline powered car, we have an electric. Instead of a gas powered furnace heating our homes, we have an electric. And so we by doing this replacement, we can actually sort of improve quality of life. Our homes can be more comfortable. Our cars can be zippier, but we can also save a lot of money. These machines are cheaper to operate. They're cheaper to maintain generally. And this is just the best thing that we can do for the climate. So Rewiring America, really, its mission is to educate people around that and to push and make sure that policy and regulation supports. So a lot of our work in the last 2 years has been on the federal policy that just got passed, the inflation.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to speak a little bit about the Inflation Reduction Act, too. So in terms of policy, you made a reference to Rewiring America doing policy work. How does that play out in the real world?
Well, I mean, 2 years ago, when we were getting started, maybe 2.5 or 3, I guess, this was before Biden was elected, before GM had really leaned into electric vehicles and made a commitment that a lot of other auto manufacturers followed. Most of that work was around education. We were writing papers and reports, mm-hmm. books. I wrote a book that I'll recommend with Saul Griffith and Laura Fraser called Electrify that really lays out this argument. And the goal of that was to put this material in a digestible form in front of, you know, an audience that didn't have very much time, aka Senate. And we did that, and we found some champions in the Senate. And then we started meeting with them regularly. This was early 2020, trying to figure out what we might do in federal legislation. And then kind of fast forward 2 years of hard work, we helped hammer out several parts of what went into the Inflation Reduction Act, including a program called HERA that provides direct rebates for low and moderate income households for getting electric appliances like water heaters and electric stoves. We also did a lot of work on the tax credit side, making sure that incentives that were there actually supported electrification instead of building continued support for fossil.
Yeah. So as I said, we're going to talk more about the IRA here in a bit, but it sounds like the culmination of a lot of work you guys have been doing. One of the things you mentioned, your book was targeted at senators to a degree. Did I hear you properly on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's targeted at, you know, no one has attention span for much these days, especially people with high power jobs like those serving in the Senate.
Yeah.
So it's really targeted to try to make the argument intuitive while still being highly quantitative and supported by data and sort of showing the pointers into the literature where you can go and find out more, but, you know, laying out the argument in a way that is easily understandable.
Yeah. So you mentioned champions in the Senate. Any names you'd care to toss out?
Senator Schumer's staff has been amazing in this whole mm-hmm. process. They've just worked tirelessly and brought this thing together despite a lot of hurdles. Senator Heinrich of New Mexico has been a huge champion. His staff as well is great to work with. Senator Tina Smith, Senator Whitehouse, Senator Mark, Senator Klobuchar. Yeah, a lot of folks really kind of joined the movement as it started ramping up.
So it must be pretty rewarding to you personally and to your organization to see that you are moving the needle on moving to a cleaner economy.
Yeah. So, this is historic climate legislation. It's worth celebrating. This is the largest investment in climate ever. We had to fight tooth and nail to get it done. And, in the same breath, I'll say it's not enough. We need to keep pushing, keep doing more. But it does really shift the market. And instead of kind of running uphill and running against obstacles, now we just have to run downhill without falling on our faces.
Yeah, I love that metaphor. So I believe you went to Washington for the signing of the IRA. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
So what was the mood like there?
The mood I described as being like a wedding. everyone was hanging out on the lawn of the White House. Everyone was dressed up. A lot of people, we had only interacted by Zoom. We'd spent a lot of time together in Zoom, but never met in real life. And the mood was just giddy. Everyone was really excited. So there was a lovely ceremony on the lawn of the White House. James Taylor played music to open it up. We heard speeches from Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, as well as a member of the Union of Electricians, which I thought was especially poignant given all of the jobs that are going to be created by this electrification. And she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, well, I guess we've been overdue for some good news like this for some time. So I'm happy that we've got this degree of good news we've got. As you indicated, well, this is not the end of the story, but, at least a step in the right direction. So let's just back up a second. So what attracted you into this challenging field of electrifying America?
Well, thanks. I appreciate the question. I've been working on climate my entire life. My background is in, I did my undergrad degree in physics and sort of made my way into technology focused solutions for climate. And this was, 12 years ago, did some work for a company that was commercializing a solar technology. And at that time, what we needed was technologies to bring down the cost of renewables like wind and solar, and technologies to bring down the cost of using that electricity to provide services like heating, transport, et cetera. Then I went back to grad school. I did my PhD at MIT, and that takes a while. It took me 7 years to do the whole thing. And by the time I was done, the world had changed. It was no longer true that we needed fundamentally new technologies in order to make renewables and clean electricity cost competitive with fossil fuels. It had already happened. The industrial scale of wind and solar had driven down the cost so much that they're the cheapest forms of new electrical generation, cheaper than gas, cheaper than coal, cheaper than nuclear. And so what we needed was not new technologies, fundamentally new technologies, but we needed to speed deployment. And that looked like electrification. That looked like, okay, we now need to transition everything to run on electricity. And a lot of that work is in public communications. It's in talking to people, like yourself, and getting the word out around what this story actually is. And it's in working on policy. So that was the transition for me. I still do some work in technology because I think there's still a role to play on fundamentally new products that will kind of take advantage of electrification and speed the transition. But a lot of the work is going to happen in policy and regulatory.
So it seems like there are, in terms of rewiring, there are three kind of key areas. One is you got to generate the electricity. Two, you got to get it to where it needs to be used. And number three, you got to have the technology per se on the end to use it. So if you could break each of those three down for us and how we're doing in each area.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great one. And maybe I'll take one step back and just to say that historically, a lot of work on climate has been focused on the supply side of this equation, on making sure that we're supplying clean electricity, supplying clean energy, and less focused on the demand side, just how we use it.
Yeah.
There have been some efforts on the side, but largely it's been focused on supply and the two have been considered separately. And what we're seeing today is that there's huge gains to be had from considering them as interlinked. And I'll talk more about this. But if we consider both how we use energy, when we use it, when we can store it, when we can dispatch it, and how we can treat all of the machines in our lives as interacting with supply, there are huge advantages to this approach. So I'll get around to answering your question now. So in terms of where we are on supply, as I mentioned previously, wind and solar are now the cheapest forms of new generation. If you look at what's called the levelized cost of electricity, which is what you get when you add up the whole life cycle of a power plant or a wind turbine, how much energy and electricity it takes to build it, transport all the supplies, staff it, maintain it, decommission it at the end of life. And you look at those total lifetime costs and divide them by the total amount of electricity generated, you get what's called the levelized cost. And it's now true as of a few years ago that wind and solar are cheaper than any other form. Depends a little bit on where you are in the country, but it's predominantly true. This means that our grid has just, you know, driven by pure capitalism, begun to get cleaner at a remarkable rate. The number of states who got the majority of their electricity from clean sources last year, I believe, I have to double check, but I believe it's above 30 as of last year, and that was up from 20 something the prior year. In California, we're now seeing moments on the grid where it's being powered 100% by clean sources. And this stuff is just starting to happen more frequently. So we're on the trajectory there in order to provide clean electricity. Then on the demand side, we kind of can break this down into a couple buckets. I like to, in the sort of 1970s thinking that was driven by oil embargoes and supply shortages, they sort of divided up the demand side in transportation, residential, commercial, industrial, and electricity generation. These somewhat arbitrary sectors that helped frame like how we could reduce our demand a little bit. Today, those buckets are less used. And one thing we've found at Rewiring America that's an effective way to think about this is instead, let's break it down into who makes the decisions about that demand. So if instead of thinking about residential, which in the old view kind of makes up a relatively small part of the pie, if we think of what are all the demands driven by decisions made by a household, that's what you drive, how you get to work, that's where you get your electricity from, that's how you heat and cool your home, how you heat your water, how you dry your clothes, decisions like that. We find that roughly 42% of U.S. energy emissions are directly driven by decisions made by a house. And then if we add commercial and small business to that, it grows to 60%. So a huge part of the pie, contrary to popular belief, is actually driven by decisions that kind of normal Americans have control of. And so what this ends up looking like is there's a set of decisions that we all make. It's not the like very frequent ones about paper, plastic, you know, how we're going to get our groceries home. It's more infrequent decisions like, okay, my water heater broke. What am I going to replace it with? Okay, my car is at its end of life. What am I going to replace it with? It's these decisions, we say made around kitchen tables, that really drive our contributions and that we really need. So that's kind of my characterization of the demand side is let's make sure that when it comes time to make these decisions, the obvious choice is to elect.
So we've got the supply on one end and the demand on the other. So what about the middle part where the electricity gets from A to B?
So this is a place we need to pay attention to.
Okay.
And by we, I mean people designing policy and regulation, not necessarily every day. If we don't do this right, it will be expensive, but there are opportunities to do it right. And I can talk about that. So something people say if they're saying, well, we can never electrify because our grid can't support it. That's a kind of scare tactic that's oft deployed. And, you know, it's a reasonable thing to think about. But the truth of the matter is our ability to scale an electric grid has been historically demonstrated at massive scale. So in order to fully electrify today, we're going to need to supply somewhere between 2 and 3 times as much electricity as we today. Historically, between 1950 and 1970, we more than quadrupled the amount of electricity. So our ability to scale a grid has been historically. And the way that worked was that GE and Westinghouse undertook a large consumer-focused campaign to drive adoption of electric appliances. Around the start of that period, electricity was largely used for home lighting and not much else. And they did a huge series of consumer-focused campaigns that showed what else you'd get, what else you'd use electricity for in your home. And people loved it, and it drove demand. And they sold a lot of electricity that way. And it was no problem to scale the grid. As a fun bit of historical trivia, Ronald Reagan was actually the spokesperson for this before he was president. And there was a primetime TV slot where he walked around his electric house and pointed at all of the electric appliances he had.
Yeah, part of the reason I'm smiling is because at 78, I lived through that era. And I absolutely remember sitting there. I also remember being in high school in the late 50s, early 60s, and a representative from GE coming and doing a program for the entire student body on the coolness of electricity.
That's amazing. I'm unfamiliar with those presentations, so that I'm learning something.
Yeah, my guess is there are a lot of stuff in my background that you'd be unfamiliar with, given our age differential. So it does seem like, so well, let me ask you a specific. Now, I can't remember the name of the electric transportation system, but there was one recently got its final approval, taking electricity from Wyoming down into the southwest of the United States. And my understanding is from the time they said, okay, we're going to do this, to the time they got the final permit was 15 years. So is that what we're looking at?
We need to do better than that. There are glaring examples of doing this poorly. And so some regulatory reform is definitely needed here. I don't want to deny that. Specifically for interstate transmission. The thing I will note, though, is that the ability to meet a good portion of that increased demand using distributed resources is not well appreciated. If the National Renewable Energy Lab from the National Labs does an assessment of rooftop solar potential across. And if you look at that, the total capacity is larger than the total extra capacity is larger than the increase that we need. So a huge portion of these can be locally generated. The critical thing is, can we get the cost of storage down low enough such that we don't need as much of that interstate transmission? In the end, it will be a mix of all of the above. We will definitely need more interstate transmission, and we need to shorten the regular cycle around. But we also need to drive down the cost of getting storage on grid so that we relieve some of the burden on those transmissions.
So it's just not as simple as like, well, we have to have more transmission lines. There are other ways of getting electricity where it's needed, like locally produce electricity.
Yeah. The other technology I'll mention here is the use of smart grid components, in particular, the use of smart electrical panels. These are devices that can limit the total instantaneous power draw of a given building or, EV charger, et cetera, so that it avoids these sort of worst case perfect storm conditions where everyone's turning on the same thing at the same time. When even without any noticeable interruption to the consumers, these demands can be orchestrated with respect to each other and relieve the total power draw on the grid, and hence relieve some of a pretty significant portion of the infrastructure upgrades needed. So I've got a paper I can refer to on this that I wrote. And if you just look at the avoided cost of upgrading the wires between the local distribution network and our houses, this is like between the pole on the street and your house, across the country, smart panels have to avoid about $250 billion.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And so these kind of crises or potential crises things that you're speaking of that can be avoided by with the smart panels, then the electricity demand can be controlled to an extent to whatever the supply is. So a situation like recently happened in California, we really want to avoid that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So earlier, I kind of vaguely talked about the way that the demand side can interact with supply side. And this is a key way where so many of the loads on our system, we don't actually need them to turn on at that exact instant.
Right.
And they can be orchestrated with respect to each other to control for these worst case scenarios. And today, we design our electric grid to withstand these worst case scenarios. So we're overbuilding the grid today. There's, if you look at the ratio between, for a given house, how much energy it actually takes in and how much energy it's designed to like possibly take in. It's a difference of about 10 or 20x, depending on where you live. And so if we can cut that overhead down a little bit, we can really control the cost and the regulatory hurdles that are going to go into that.
So I just want to check, you used the term distributed resources. I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
So that's a kind of broad term. It includes everything from rooftop solar to small scale wind to distributed storage as well. So batteries placed either usually behind the meter. On a house or at the level of an intual. The other, I will add to that, the collection of technologies called demand response, which is, you know, there's a, the prime example is there's a little, you know, controller that you put on your water heater that allows it to interact with the grid. And when the grid is able to supply power, the water heater turns on and makes a bunch of hot water and stores it in that tank. And when the grid says, hey, actually, I could use a little relief, the water heater doesn't run, but you still have that hot water waiting for you.
Yeah. So this all does make so much sense. I mean, I've seen the charts of how much electricity is demanded by the system, and the difference between peak demand and let's say 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning is just stunning how much difference there is. And it just makes so much sense. Like I have an electric vehicle and I've taken on myself just voluntarily setting it up so it charges between midnight and 5 a.m. just because I know that. But it sounds like what you're pointing towards is a system that does that for us.
Yeah. So most of these things can be automated. In the case of the electric vehicle, now most of the manufacturers supply a remote protocol that control it. And you can, so you could subscribe to a service that they're called managed charging services, that where you tell it like, well, I care about saving money, so only charge when it's cheap. Or you could say, I care about, you know, saving the planet, so only charge when the grid is, or things like
that. Yeah. So a lot of exciting stuff there. So let's just change gears just a little bit here. What's your view on the role of nuclear going forward? And let's break it up into two parts, existing nuclear and let's say new nuclear.
Yeah. So nuclear is a very hotly contested topic. And I will say I try to remain somewhat agnostic about it. I went to MIT. I'm a technology focused person. The promise of nuclear is very compelling. There are amazing new nuclear technologies available today that are inherently safe, that are extremely attractive propositions. I will say though, that to a large respect, we may not need them. At least in the short term. Wind and solar are so cheap, batteries are becoming so cheap that there's a lot of work to do before we're in a place where we need it. So I try to remain somewhat agnostic on this point. I'm for electrification. I'm for electrification powered by clean electricity. So if that electricity is produced without carbon, I'll use it.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, wind and solar are the cheapest ways to do that today, especially with respect to new generation. Existing generation, I tend to come down on the side of, well, if we can do it safely, let's keep these things on the grid and they'll ease our transition and allow us to turn on our gas peaker plants a little bit less.
So a couple kind of related things. You've used the term everywhere or everything a couple of times in terms of electrification. So what about industries like cement, steel, long distance, marine and air travel?
Yeah. So I love the question. We should, every time I say everything, we should put a little parenthetical almost.
Okay.
But in all of these industries, there are really exciting things happening, moving towards electrification. In almost any version of the future, we're going to have extremely cheap, clean electricity during certain hours of the day. When the sun is out, we're going to have a lot of solar capacity because it's so cheap, and we're going to need things to do with that electricity. And the industry is already responding to this. So there's new exciting ways we can electrify industry using heat pumps, for instance. A lot of industry is driven on thermal systems. Heat pumps are a way to provide a given temperature working fluid extremely efficiently. And for a big part of the industrial uses, namely what's called low temperature heat, heat pumps are an extremely attractive proposition. For the higher temperature heat, things for very hot industrial processes, I think we'll probably just end up using conventional electric resistance powered by extremely cheap electricity from solar during the day.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you really can see a future in which energy intensive things like cement and steel can be powered purely electrically?
So I want to stop slightly short of that, just okay. because these are chemical processes that some of them do actually require inherent carbon related processes. But there are very exciting zero carbon technologies for both cement and steel on the horizon. We need to be investing massively in both of those. The other one you mentioned is aviation.
Yeah. And long distance ocean transport.
Yeah. So for aviation, short haul is already going electric. We see headlines where the airlines are investing in electric fleets. For long haul, I tend to think, and this is just my opinion, I think there are reasonable folks may vary here, that we're going to do this with biofuels. There's not enough land to power kind of everything we need from biofuels, but biofuels are an extremely precious resource that we can use for these very hard to electrify things, like long haul flight in particular, because the weight constraints of long haul flight are very stringent. Batteries are somewhat heavy. We can't just stick more batteries in our 787s and get them to go, because you know the added weight means we need to carry more fuel, means there's added weight, etc.
Right.
So these very energy dense biofuels that are zero carbon are going to be an essential resource for that, in my opinion.
Okay, so let's once again changing gears a little bit here. You made some reference earlier on to the free market, and I believe that's the term you use anyway. That's what we'll use for a working term for the moment. So, and I'm just thinking, for instance, of Texas, which is a big petrochemical fossil fuel state, but is also one of the maybe the leading state in terms of amount of electricity that's generated by wind, which seems to me like a kind of a market driven thing. So my bigger question is, as we go forward, is the market an asset or a liability?
Well, that's an impossible question to answer. The way I think about this is we need to be designing this transition such that the market aids and abets it. So the market is an extremely powerful force, and it's hard to control. Sometimes it does good things, a lot of times it does bad things. And so there's a lot of instances, such as your example of Texas wind, where it's amazing. The market has driven Texas to be one of the biggest wind producing country, and that's incredible. So I believe the thing I referred to earlier was a slightly broader statement of wind and solar are the cheapest forms of new generation. As we increase electricity demand, we're going to be increasing generation, and it's more likely than not, if we get the storage situation right, that's installing a bunch of wind and solar. The way we kind of guide that a little bit is with types of incentives that are in the IRA, where we get tax credits for putting those preferential forms of generation.
Yeah, I love that term, guiding. So by providing certain incentives, you still allow consumers and utilities and so on to make their own choices. So it's a little bit of a blend of the two concepts, you know, a directed or regulatory versus people and businesses making their own choices.
Yeah. And so one of the biggest ways this plays out is on the demand side, where we have these electric technologies that on an ongoing basis, like year over year, they're much cheaper to operate. So, you know, we estimated that an average American household could save about $1,800 a year by switching to electric technology. But there's still this upfront cost issue, where when your car breaks, the new electric vehicle costs more than the new gas vehicle. When your furnace breaks, the new heat pump costs a little bit more than furnace. And so a lot of decision making is driven by that upfront cost rather than the ongoing cost, even if these things pay for themselves in, you know, 5 or 10 years. And so what the IRA does is it puts in place upfront incentives that make the electric option the cheaper one. And so it kind of unlocks the savings potential year over year by shifting that upfront.
Yep. So I'm going to brag on myself here for a little bit, because I've experienced exactly what you're talking about. I put solar on my roof up here in Washington State several years ago, and I have an electric vehicle. My home is all electric. I got an induction stovetop. I got two heat pumps, actually. And because I have a two-story house in a west-facing neighborhood, which is really difficult to cool in the summertime on both sides. So I got two heat pumps in there. And my electric bill this summer has been 69 cents per day. And that, so that includes driving my car and so on and so forth. So yeah, there were upfront decisions and costs, but now I'm reaping those rewards. And of course, when it comes time for me to sell my house, the people that buy my house, all those rewards are going to be built in for them in the form of the house. So it is pretty exciting.
Well, that's great work. I appreciate it. And it's great to hear it's paying itself back.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just talk kind of from the little bit of a political cultural perspective. And let's use the term environmentally concerned groups. So one of the things I worry about is that the groups that are concerned about our climate and environmental future tend to have their niches. And it's almost sometimes like we're not talking to each other, we're not coordinating and so on. So do you see that? Do you have any concerns in that direction?
Oh, definitely. I think that's an accurate assessment. One of the reasons that I'm so bullish on electrification is that it does cut across some ideological line.
It does.
In that it's focused on economics, focused on saving people money, it's focused on improving air quality. These are things that pull across the aisle, that everyone cares about these things. These are also climate strategy, but they do serve these other metrics, job creation, air quality, and financial systems that are more broadly.
Yeah.
And I'll share a quick story. In a lot of the work on the federal policy, we spend a lot of time trying to rally support on the Hill, on Capitol Hill. I created a heat pump costume. Spent a couple of days walking around Capitol Hill, talking to random people on the street. We did some video spots with senators. We just tried to really rally support for heat pumps, because heat pumps, they're less sexy than solar panels. They're less sexy than electric vehicles, but they're just, and so one of the days we were shooting was standing on the steps of the Capitol building and ran into the senator from my home state of Indiana, who's a Republican. And we had a lovely conversation about heat pumps. He knew a lot about them.
Oh, wow.
And he was hugely supportive. We used slightly different words to talk about them. I was noticing in the conversation. But he was a huge fan of heat pumps. No pun intended. and so like learning to have these conversations, I think is really important and is going to be one of the ways we can get around the concern.
Yeah. So that kind of takes me to, we're getting close to the end here. We do have an election coming up midterm here. So do you have thoughts about the importance or the impact of this election?
It's hugely important. We need to keep up the momentum we've built with the IRA. The election will determine our ability to do that. I do think that electrification tends to encompass a set of kitchen table issues that makes a really good platform for the folks running in the midterms. And we've been doing a lot of work on this in America, getting ready and helping people position this as part of their platform, the money savings, the job creation, the improvements to air quality and the addressing.
Yeah, I think that's really an important way to go. And I do feel some consternation when I look at how the various political breakdowns, how their approach towards energy and climate and the environment, it tends to be down the list some after things like inflation, crime, immigration, those kind of things. So I think that probably one of Rewiring America's jobs is to move those climate and environment issues up the list. So, and what you just pointed out there is that really the candidates have a responsibility to be part of that too. Because one of the things I say is if we lose on climate, we lose on everything. So it's
true. And you're right. There is a responsibility. But these things are so interlinked. You mentioned inflation. Nearly half of the inflationary pressure that we're feeling right now is driven directly by rising fossil fuel prices.
Yeah.
Electricity prices are inherently more stable and inherently because they're regulated. Rather than being highly influenced by, what some dictator abroad is doing,
yeah.
Electricity markets are regulated. They're influenced by fossil fuel prices, but the influence is much more diffuse. So they're way more stable. And so by switching to electric technologies, we're actually insulating ourselves from these inflationary pressures, from these supply shocks. And so it's part of a platform where people care about inflation and what they're feeling like. We should be talking about it in the context of these electric.
Yeah, that's a great point. I have a friend who He's a Republican. He's the mayor of one of the towns close to where I live. And he's very much of an electrification buff. And the main reason he is because he looks at security in terms of what you're talking about. We have to rely on these unstable countries that may not be friends of ours. And he loves to look and say, look, we can create all the energy that we need right here. And we don't have to rely on anybody else. So I think that's really an important point.
Yeah. And in the notes, I'll refer to an article I wrote about this notion of energy independence, where it's been energy dependence has been ascribed to being a net exporter of energy as a country. But true energy independence is really producing the energy you need right at home. And that's electrification. The average distance between a household and the nearest electricity generation facility in the U.S. is just 5 miles.
Really?
We are generating electricity throughout our country. We don't trade electricity overseas. This is inherently a sort of a secure way we should be capitalizing.
Yeah. Well, so we're at the end here. So I'll just ask Sam, anything else that I haven't asked you about or that you'd like to put out there?
So I'd really like to direct folks to this tool that we built to help them understand the money that's available to them in the IRA to help them electrify. And I'll put a link in the notes. It's called our calculator, Rewiring America calculator for the Inflation Reduction Act. And I want everyone to know there's money waiting for every one of us in the IRA, and it's income. You know, it's what we need to do is go get it. There's an electric bank account waiting for us. And in some cases it has a bunch of money in it. I'll refer folks to that tool in terms of understanding what's actually available, because, you know, trying to read the bill text, you know, it's legally, it's hard to get through. It's confusing. There's a lot of measures out there. So we've tried to kind of boil it down. You go on there, you put in where you live, what your income is, how many dependents you have. We don't store any of that information, clear. That'll show what amounts of things are available to you and help you kind of make a plan for, okay, well, I could get a bunch of money for a new water heater, and I noticed my water heater is 10 years old. So why don't I do that?
Yeah. So just a last minute full disclosure here. I got a rebate notice from my local utility, Tacoma Public Utility. So in addition to the IRA funds, I'm going to get some help in zero interest loans and things like that. One of the things I was curious about is, how old is my hot water heater? And so I contacted the manufacturer with the serial number on it. My hot water heater was manufactured in 1992. So I think it's time. So, And I love your expression, sort of like, well, there's IRA money lying around out there, but it's up to us to go out and get it. So I'm going to look forward to digging into that tool that you mentioned and encourage other folks to do that.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. And yeah, I'll just add to that we just installed heat pumps at my parents' house in rural Indiana, and even there the local electrical co-op gave us a healthy like $3,000 for heat pumps. It's just, there are, in addition to the IRA funds, there's utility and state money lying as well.
Yeah, well, those electric or those heat pumps just make so much sense that it's great to see that it's within the reach of most households. So anyway, Dr. Sam Kalish, been so great talking with you. I appreciate you taking the time, and good luck to you going on into the future.
Yeah, thanks very much. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much to Dr. Sam Kalish for sketching out and detailing where we are in Rewiring America, where we're headed, and why we're doing all of that. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 is a far-reaching piece of legislation that can and will affect each one of us. As Sam points out in this conversation, there is money there for all of us. A great resource in figuring out what you qualify for can be found at Rewiring America's website and an associated calculator. See our show notes for that and other access points for making sure that you take advantage of these programs that will not only save you money, but will also result in a smaller carbon footprint. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. And you can also check out show notes at ccltacoma.org. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced radio programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, And always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.